Good evening, everyone. So it may sound slightly odd, but I find the book of Ecclesiastes strangely refreshing to read. And I think the main reason for that is that I believe we live in a world of baseless optimism. Optimism that with enough time and effort, we humans can solve all the big problems that have plagued humankind throughout recorded history and make some lasting progress. Optimism that through science and technology we can somehow prolong life, avoid death, even correct the effects of our greed and consumption on the earth itself. And I call this optimism baseless, as there doesn't seem to be a single piece of evidence from history that we have the moral fortitude to tackle even the most basic of problems, such as poverty, let alone problems of natural resource depletion and environmental destruction. In fact, there's really only evidence to the contrary, that given the choice, humans will always choose personal gain over any other moral or collective pursuit. And granted, there are bright spots in history, individuals who have notably chosen the good of the many over the few. And we would contend that Scripture contains many such historical characters. But the overall collective story that human history tells is pretty bleak. At least for me, it gives little to no reason for optimism outside of the supernatural. Now, it's understandable why that's an unacceptable conclusion for those that deny the supernatural, as it creates this crisis of purpose. So I'd suggest, as we'll see, I think a little later from Scripture tonight, this baseless optimism fills the void of purpose, but it has no real substance, and it really leaves pleasure seeking as really the only logical way left to order our lives. Which is decidedly individual and opposed to the greater good, we could say, of humankind. It's opposed to solving these problems that our world gives such lip service to desiring to solve, but in all recorded history has really made effectively no progress. So what I find refreshing then about Ecclesiastes is that it's honest about the state of humankind, about the pursuit of living life as an end unto itself, about what and about who we naturally are. It strips away any of this baseless optimism, and it provides the perspective that in and of itself, life is incomplete. It's imperfect, and it's ultimately unfulfilling. And despite the extent of our human efforts, we as individuals, as mortal humans, simply do not have the power or the capacity to change any of that in a meaningful or in a lasting way. And this was something that the writer of Ecclesiastes himself, whom I'm going to assume is Solomon tonight, had difficulty accepting. It led to a lot of frustration, and it's something I think we all have difficulty accepting. As we all naturally conflate pleasure with fulfillment. And it's something that we all must accept, however, I believe, if we are to understand and appreciate God's salvation provided through Jesus Christ and the whole concept of living by faith. And I think the book of Ecclesiastes helps us to get there. So we'll start with Ecclesiastes 1. We'll deal tonight with really the prologue of the book, which runs the first 11 verses of chapter 1. And then we'll also deal with Solomon's description of his quest for the meaning of life, which runs from chapter 1, verse 12, really to the end of chapter 2. So just looking again at verses 1 through 3 then, we read, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities. All is vanity. What profit hath a man of all his labor, which he taketh under the sun?" And the first three verses really, I think, help clue us into the perspective from which Solomon writes this book. The first phrase that is particularly telling and repeated is, "All is vanity." Other translations read futile or meaningless in place of vanity. And indeed, the 32 times that this word appears outside of the book of Ecclesiastes, it's almost in half of those occurrences used in association with idols and their uselessness. On several other occasions, it carries the meaning of fleeting or temporary. In Ecclesiastes, phrases using this word vanity occur in various forms at least 35 times. It's unmistakably a central theme of the book. We know emphatically from the rest of Scripture, of course, that God has not created an environment for humankind that is completely devoid of meaning. At the same time, though, we also know from the rest of Scripture that the meaning that does exist lies in the being of God himself, in his character and his purpose. So I think we really have to conclude that the book is primarily written from the perspective of a man searching for meaning in life solely in the created order of things. In other words, solely in what he's able to deduce and experience through his own senses, his intellect, and his powers of reasoning, what he can experience and observe. And this, I think, is brought out further in the phrase "under the sun," which, out of all of Scripture, only occurs in this book, Ecclesiastes, and it does occur 29 times within it. The throne of God we understand to be heaven itself. Therefore, this phrase "under the sun" can also be seen to support that the primary scope of this book is restricted to the realm of the created, as opposed to one including the Creator. And I think when we read the book, we have to remember that God's existence and power was never in doubt to Solomon himself, who from a young age prayed to God for help. But nonetheless, the scope of the book is the things under the sun, which I think is helpful to remember as we read through it. So really, I think Ecclesiastes can be understood as sort of a thought experiment. Can we discover meaning, a logical framework for human behavior and life, meaning in life, solely from our own powers of thought and the experience of life itself? And it's certainly not a book that leaves us in question as to Solomon's conclusion on those questions, even from the very start of the book. His conclusion is stated really right in the first few verses. We can't discover meaning in mortal life in and of itself with only our minds and our bodies. But more than that, we can't, because there is no meaning in the created order of things in and of themselves. Everything under the sun is vanity and meaningless. And of course, God being the source of meaning, the only source of logical, meaningful framework for human behavior, which is where ultimately Solomon concludes eventually in chapter 12. And Solomon knew this from a young age, I believe. He knew where to seek guidance from. He knew that God was really the only source of the wisdom and strength that he needed to do his job. But not in the last. I think the book illustrates the struggle that we all have throughout our lives in placing our trust in God and making him our priority over the millions of naturally appealing but meaningless alternatives in the world. And it's definitely a conflict that is common to all people. To pursue fleeting fulfillment offered through pleasure and through hard work, or to seek a purpose higher and greater than ourselves. So looking at verse 3, Solomon, his underlying belief, I think, comes through when he asks this rhetorical question, "What profit hath a man of all his labor?" The answer is thought to be obvious to the reader, as well as it is to Solomon. There is no profit. The question also involves us as the readers, both because it's an unanswered question in the text, but also makes an appeal to common experience and knowledge. So Solomon is really suggesting that the realization of this meaninglessness of life without the acknowledgement of God is actually a realization that's common to all. It's also interesting to consider the range of how this word is used, this word labor, in the King James. It's a fairly neutral term, labor, that is, but the word is more commonly translated throughout the Old Testament with a negative connotation, such as hard work, misery, or drudgery. And most or many modern translations translate it here in Ecclesiastes as toil. So let's just continue reading here from verse 4, and we'll read to verse 11, this first section. So one generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. The sun also riseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place where he arose. The wind goeth toward the south, and turneth about unto the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to his circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. The thing that hath been, it is which shall be. And that which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new? It hath been already of old time, which was before us. There is no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come with those that shall come after. So starting with verse 4, there's the concept of this seemingly endless cyclical nature of human existence. Generations come and go. In verse 11, this thought is brought to a close. Every generation is rendered indistinct by the passing of further generations. As with the passage of time, all remembrance of previous generations is eventually lost. And within these two sort of bookend verses, verses 8 and 9 add this detail that in addition to the lost memory of previous generations, so too there's no new thing under the sun. Although we may think we've discovered something new, there's little guarantee that it's actually not a rediscovery of something that's been forgotten. And with this same style, Solomon projects this wearying cyclical interpretation onto all of creation, verses 5 to 7. The wind whirls about continually. It blows every direction in a circuit. The rivers flow into the ocean, but it's never filled. The waters return to their starting point. The sun rises and goes down, and Solomon provides this imagery of it hurrying back to the place where it started, as if it somehow has to hustle back to make it in time to rise again. So despite the fact that, as Solomon states in verse 4, the earth abides forever, the way in which he describes the natural world is itself bound up in this cyclical, unfulfilling weariness that humankind, he states, universally experiences and is aware of. Now, we've established that the perspective Solomon's writing from here is life under the sun. So putting God to one side, so to speak, for this consideration. So it's interesting to consider the alternate perspective, a perspective of faith when observing these natural phenomena. And that perspective comes in a very similar vein from David, Solomon's father, of course, in Psalm 19. I'll just go there for a moment. Very well-known psalm. And reading at Psalm 19, verse 1, we read, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. Day unto day uttereth speech, and night unto night showeth knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them hath he set a tabernacle for the sun, which is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, and rejoiceth as a strong man to run a race." So David then here, obviously speaking from a perspective of belief, of faith, interprets similarly the movement of the sun, but here as one rejoicing as a strong man to run a race, as opposed to hasting back to its place to rise once more after setting. So instead of this infinite cyclical wearying story, it's contrasted with vigor and the prospect of a race, which really amounts to a finite burst of effort that's followed generally by a period of rest. Now, obviously, these are both just descriptions of the movement of the sun, but I think they demonstrate the projection of the perspective of these two authors onto the inanimate object of the sun. David, in faith, sees strength, effort, and prospect of rest. Solomon, in his Ecclesiastes perspective, sees a wearying, repetitive cycle. Instructive, I think, for us as well. Do we see our lives as a wearying, meaningless, repetitive cycle? Or as a race for which we've been equipped with strength and after which we anticipate rest? I know in my own perspective and experience, it's hard to maintain this faithful perspective. Obviously, harder in certain times more than others. Our lives are patterned and cyclical. But when we are feeling weary, that everything maybe is a grind, what better a reminder we get here from the contrast of Solomon and David, that indeed life in and of itself is wearying and meaningless, but that if we look to God through prayer and through the many faithful words and perspectives we find in his word, he'll restore in us this perspective of faith and of endurance in a race, imagery that we find throughout the New Testament as well. And Paul in Romans draws these two perspectives together, I think, illustrating to us that in fact our lives will be living out of this conflict between these two perspectives, between faithful endurance and weariness. I'll just go to Romans 8 for a minute. Romans 8, verse 20. So Romans 8:20 reads, "For the creature was made subject to vanity, not willingly, but by reason of him who hath subjected the same in hope. Because the creature itself also shall be delivered from the bondage of corruption, into the glorious liberty of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain together until now. Are not only they, but ourselves also, which have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting for the adoption, to wit, the redemption of our body. For we are saved by hope, but hope that is seen is not hope. For what a man seeth, why doth he yet hope for? But if we hope for what we see not, then we with patience wait for it. So Paul, in this section, agrees with Solomon that indeed we are made subject to this meaninglessness or futility that Solomon identifies in Ecclesiastes. He writes here that the whole creation groans and travails in pain until now. This now being the time of the revelation of salvation through Jesus. He writes here that even the early believers who had the first fruits of the Spirit even grown within themselves with this type of conflict as they await the redemption of their bodies, the fulfillment of this promise of being made like him, being set free from this conflict at his return. And hope in that is what God has given to sustain us through this often wearying cycle of life. The same hope sustained David and made him right as he did in Psalm 19, and it sustained all of the faithful. So Paul really clearly here sums up the conflict that Solomon in part is presenting in Ecclesiastes. It's true. The created order of things are in literal bondage to corruption. The bondage isn't pleasant. It resembles hard labor, which is by definition cyclical. It's repetitive. Neither is there meaning in the labor in and of itself. Rather, the significance, the meaning of a human life is only realized through endurance of this bondage in faith, through this hope that is a sustaining quality. And the significance or the meaning is the ultimate salvation that's granted those who endure the labor and as a result are adopted into this glorious liberty of the children of God. To the mindset of Solomon in Ecclesiastes, then, everything under the sun is under bondage to a repeating cycle of endless futile toil. To Paul the Apostle, the natural world and all life in it is indeed under bondage as well, but the difference is that liberation is sure and imminent. So moving back to Ecclesiastes and out of this introductory prologue of the book, we'll look at the next sort of digestible section, which comes from chapter 1, verse 12 to the end of chapter 2. Within this bigger section, verses 13 to 18 amount to an introduction to Solomon's search for meaning. And within this short introduction in these verses, he anticipates the ultimate depressing conclusion of his inquiry. So we'll just read those verses 13 to 18. And I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. That which is crooked cannot be made straight, and that which is wanting cannot be numbered. I communed with mine own heart, saying, Lo, I am come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge, and I gave my heart to know wisdom, to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is vexation of spirit. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. So this section, I think, we could see being broken into two separate chunks itself, two introductory reflections, which seems like a bit of an oxymoron, but nonetheless, introductory reflections on in verses 13 and 14 and verses 16 and 17, each are followed by these two short supporting proverbs, one in each of verse 15 and 18. So Solomon has an interesting style here. He explains his methodology of his search for meaning in these verses, but also he states his sweeping conclusions at the same time, all in this little seven-verse introduction. So verses 13 to 15 describe his overall approach to this search for meaning through wisdom, which I take to mean the full concentration and application of his reasoning or mental abilities. And even though Solomon has admittedly undertaken this search for meaning under the sun, so to speak, or without the influence of God, God still cannot be completely left out of the search. In verse 13, Solomon characterizes life under the sun as sore travail, or as other translations render it, an evil task or unhappy business that God has given the sons of men to be busy with. Evil, presumably, because there is no meaning to the work or business or task under the sun when pursued as an end unto itself. He summarizes his overall findings here in verse 15 with this proverb, that which is crooked cannot be made straight, and that which is wanting cannot be numbered. So in all his wisdom, Solomon concludes that there is an innate deficiency in life, something crooked under the sun that humankind can never account for, correct, or address on their own. Verses 16 and 17 continue this introductory section where Solomon describes his qualifications for undertaking this search for meaning. Most importantly, he possessed more wisdom than any who had come before him in Jerusalem, but he had also gained, he says, much life experience up to this point. And he resolved to apply all of these resources wholly to this pursuit of meaning. And this included a seeking a fuller understanding of wisdom by also coming to an understanding of folly and madness, which we could see as the opposites of wisdom. But despite all these qualifications and his methodology, he again pre-summarizes his findings with this simple proverbial conclusion in verse 18, where he writes, "In much wisdom is much grief, and he that increases wisdom increaseth sorrow." So entering chapter 2 now, we move from this introduction to the more detailed rendition of Solomon's search for meaning. We won't read chapter 2 again in its entirety, but verses 1 to 11 describe his pursuit of meaning through pleasure, through satisfying every desire of his eyes, as he puts it in verse 10. And even before providing us all the details of this particular quest, as he often does through this book, he provides his conclusion right in verse 1. Pleasure is meaningless. Throughout all this pleasure-seeking, Solomon reminds the reader that though he kept his head, so to speak, or kept some manner of analytical detachment and dedication to searching out the meaning in pleasure. In verse chapter 2, verse 3, he describes him giving himself unto wine, yet still acquainting his heart with wisdom. In verse 9, being greater than all before him, yet his wisdom, he says, remained with him. Out of all his pleasure seeking, it seems Solomon's creative pursuits brought him the closest to meaning. Just looking at verse 10, we read, "And whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. And this was my portion of all my labor." So despite his labor being ultimately meaningless, it seems that this labor, his great works, his building projects, and his labor in building this empire brought him some genuine joy. Yet verse 11 continues, "Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun." Now, it's interesting that up to this point, we've read this phrase, "no profit," under the sun several times, yet there's been no explanation as to why Solomon has determined there to be no profit to any of the labor under the sun. And that explanation really comes in the next section of chapter 2, from verses 12 to 23. It's a really simple explanation. And it amounts to this universal constant of death in the human experience. Verses 12 to 17 describe how death renders both wisdom and folly under the sun meaningless. And verses 18 to 23 describe how death also renders all toil or labor under the sun meaningless. Let's just look at verses 12 to 17. "And I turned myself to behold wisdom and madness and folly, for what can the man do that cometh after the king? Even that which hath been already done. Then I saw that wisdom excelleth folly, as far as light excelleth darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walketh in darkness. And I myself perceived also that one event happeneth to them all. Then said I in my heart, as it happeneth to the fool, so it happeneth even to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart that this also is vanity, for there is no remembrance of the wise more than of the fool forever, seeing that which is now in the days to come shall all be forgotten. And how dieth the wise man as the fool? Therefore I hated life, because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me, for all is vanity and vexation of spirit." So Solomon begins this section in verse 12 to 17 with an approach that's very in tune with the rest of the wisdom writings, as they're known in the Old Testament, such as Proverbs, and would really be taken for granted by the reader that's familiar with the rest of the Old Testament. Wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. Darkness is this allegory of confusion, and light of clarity and of purpose. But then he shows how from this under the sun perspective of Ecclesiastes, that value system is turned on its head. From this perspective, death is an equalizer that normalizes wisdom and folly. No matter how wise or how foolish, death combined with the passage of time erases all memory of our actions, making this common wisdom of placing a higher value on wisdom over folly ultimately meaningless. And the frustration, I think, of Solomon really comes through in these verses, that despite being this wisest man in history, his wisdom on its own can provide no lasting, meaningful end, no path around the inevitability of death and the obscurity that quickly follows. But again, it's interesting to compare the above the sun or the faithful perspective that we get in the Psalms. We'll just go to another Psalm, Psalm 49. So looking at Psalm 49, verses 10 and 11, section dealing really with the same material. For he seeth that wise men die, likewise the fool and the brutish person perish, and leave their wealth to others. Their inward thought is that their houses shall continue forever, and their dwelling places to all generations. They call their lands after their own names. So this psalm makes really the same observation about those under the sun that Solomon makes himself in Ecclesiastes. The wise share the fate of the fool. Yet, unlike Solomon, there's this belief stated that their legacy will somehow be eternal, that their wisdom and their labor will have meant something. And this is really the baseless optimism that still pervades the world we live in, the world under the sun. Solomon, despite his own failures, did, as he set out to do in the beginning of Ecclesiastes, maintain his wisdom and his clarity, despite all the accomplishment and riches that he amassed for himself. Through it all, he didn't lose sight of the futility of it all. And jumping down further in Psalm 49, we get the differing conclusion of faith that really has everything to do with this insurmountable problem of death that Solomon identified. Looking at verse 14 of Psalm 49. Like sheep they are laid in the grave, death shall feed on them, and the upright shall have dominion over them in the morning. And their beauty shall consume in the grave from their dwelling. But God will redeem my soul from the power of the grave, for he shall receive me. So in Solomon's seeking of meaning under the sun, death was the sticking point. The transience of life made meaning impossible. Perhaps unsurprising then, yet nonetheless incredible, that redemption from death is specifically God's promise, promise to and hope of the faithful who focus their thoughts and their attention on things above the sun rather than those things under the sun. Continuing on, though, in Ecclesiastes, going on to verse 18 of chapter 2, Solomon turns his attention to the toil or the hard work and effort under the sun. Perhaps if wisdom in and of itself can provide no lasting meaning, perhaps there's permanence and meaning achieved through toil, through hard work, through building or creative enterprises, much like the men of Psalm 49, whose inward thought was that their legacy would somehow endure. But again, his conclusion and his frustration is immediate in verse 18. Yea, I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me. And who knoweth whether he shall be a wise man or a fool? Yet he shall have rule over all my labor, wherein I have labored, and wherein I have showed myself wise under the sun. This is also vanity. And he goes on further to despair that he ever engaged in this toil, in this labor, simply for the fact that whoever inherits it, whether foolish or wise, they'll be undeserving for the simple fact that they have not worked for it themselves. This he calls vanity, but also he calls it a great evil. And death isn't mentioned explicitly in this section from verse 18-23, but it's really carried over from the previous section as the perpetrator of this great evil, which he continues to bewail down into verse 23. We'll finish up, though, tonight in verses 24 to 26 of chapter 2, as it acts as the conclusion of his search here for meaning in the created order of things. So looking at verses 24 to 26, we read, "There's nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink, that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw, that it was from the hand of God. For who can eat, or who else can hasten hereunto more than I? For God giveth to a man that is good in his sight wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner he giveth travail to gather and to heap up, that he may give to him that is good before God. This also is vanity and vexation of spirit." So this little three-verse section is the first of six such concluding statements that Solomon makes throughout the book that allow for this possibility that life can be enjoyed to a certain extent in the present under the sun. Here he advocates, though resignedly, pursuing the simple pleasures of life under the sun: food, drink, and the fleeting joy brought about by hard work and accomplishing tasks, which he even experienced this joy in verse 10. He's very guarded in his recommendations, though. He uses this phrase, "There is nothing better." He's recognizing that still there's little comfort. There's no lasting profit to be gained in enjoying these things. But that under the sun, there's really no preferable alternative to at least deriving some joy from these things. And in verse 25 reminds us that indeed these things are from God. And despite his perspective and his thought experiment of things under the sun, he still acknowledges God as the creator. Now, verse 26 almost sounds as if Solomon is suggesting that God blesses the faithful with good things and gives the sinner bad things. But that interpretation contradicts his earlier assertion that a fool may very likely inherit much from a wise man. So rather, as he often does in these concluding statements, I believe Solomon is contrasting the faithful to those under the sun here. We can note that the blessings granted to the man that is good in his sight here are not at all material. They are wisdom, knowledge, and joy. And this is contrasted with the so-called sinner, or we could call them the person under the sun. Their lot is to toil to amass material things. And the ultimate end of those material blessings being given to the faithful seems to speak not of these things being directly taken from the sinner and given to the righteous, but rather that perhaps in this seemingly endless economy of toil, this is the mechanism by which God in his mercy redistributes material blessings to the faithful, who to this point in the section have received wisdom, knowledge, and joy, yet they also practically need material provision to survive mortal life as well. And we get a similar indication from Proverbs 13 and 28. We won't go there now, but we get a similar indication that indeed that is how God works. But from the perspective of someone under the sun who wishes to build something lasting and meaningful in his life. This mechanism we can see, I think, how is truly vexing and provides none of the type of meaning that he is looking for. So just in conclusion then, I've suggested we live in a world where the baseless optimism of the so-called foolish men of Psalm 49 is the prevailing coping mechanism, I think, for this same anxiety and frustration that Solomon describes here in death, and in being unable to build something lasting, something meaningful in his life when it's lived as an end unto itself. But our meaning is in a crucified Christ, and in symbolically dying with him, we're called to put aside the pursuit of building a corruptible and quickly forgotten monument to ourselves, but rather to become part of a lasting building, which for now consists solely of people, but at his return will be this literal and eternal city. And we no longer have the anxiety and the frustration of trying to cling on to what we have under the sun now, which Solomon points out is completely meaningless anyways. But we have a hope of that day, of that better and lasting city whose builder and maker, thankfully, is God. We have that hope to sustain us as it has all the faithful.